primary lesson here is that freedom is not an end in and of itself, but freedom is only meaningful when it leads to Kabbalas O Malchus Shemayim. And that is what's an interesting point about Shavuos. I'm not going to talk about this today mainly, but just to throw out a simple observation. Although all of us know that Shavuos is the sixth of Sivan, that is not how the Torah describes it. The Torah describes Shavuos as the 50th day in your Omer count. Now, it is only because of our fixed calendar that that is going to be the sixth of Sivan. But in the time of the Beis HaMikdash, when there was no fixed calendar, and Rosh Chodesh was determined by witnesses sighting the moon, and any given month could either be 30 days or 31 days. I'm sorry, 29 days or 30 days. I'm sorry, 29 days or 30 days. So the Gemara actually says it is entirely possible for Shavuos to be the fifth if both Nisan and Iyar are 30 days. It is entirely possible for Shavuos to be the seventh if Nisan and Iyar are both 29 days. And Shavuos will be the sixth when Nisan is 30 and Iyar is 29. And that's our present calendar. But the point I'm making is, the holiday of Shavuos is not intrinsically linked to a calendar date at all. It is the 50th day from the Omer count that begins the second of Pesach. And the Mefarshim explain, this is because Shavuos is not a separate holiday. Shavuos is simply the conclusion of Pesach. In fact, some Mefarshim explain that all of the days between Pesach and Shavuos are like a long Chol HaMoed. So when you tell your boss you're taking off for Chol HaMoed, you might be able to take a longer vacation than the boss might imagine. In fact, there actually is a svara, although I don't think it's a very brilliant idea, but I don't think it's supported by any source. You know, we know that during the Sfira period, our minhag is we don't take haircuts and we don't make weddings. So the reason that's given is because we're in mourning because of the deaths of the students of Rabbi Akiva. But somebody wanted to suggest, a modern academic actually wanted to suggest that the basis for the original prohibition against haircuts and weddings is not because of mourning, but it's because those are observances connected to Chol HaMoed. Now, the chayra, that should also mean you wouldn't be allowed to do laundry during that period, but that would have been too difficult, so they didn't do that. So according to that, the observances are not sad observances. The observances are based on Chol HaMoed. As they say, it's a very brilliant, interesting idea, but if you go back to the Tshuvas HaGaonim, the Gaonim already say that it's connected to the deaths of the students of Rabbi Akiva. But the idea that Shavuos is not a separate holiday, all of that is connected to the idea that freedom without Torah is not only bad, not only worthless, but it's actually destructive. The Gemara itself makes this point in a different context by pointing out that the korban that we bring on Pesach, the grain korban that we bring on Pesach, is barley, the omer, barley. And barley was commonly fed to animals. And the grain offering that we bring on Shavuos is wheat, out of which we make the bread that human beings eat. So the transition from Pesach to Shavuos is the movement from animal liberation to human dignity in that way. I may have mentioned before Pesach that this is also connected in part to the idea of Ashkenazim have a custom. It's not a din, but it is a custom that at the Seder we eat a hard-boiled egg. And there are many, many reasons why we eat a hard-boiled egg at the Seder. The Ishbitzer, who was Rav Tzadok's Rebbe, the Ishbitzer was a great, great Hasidic Rebbe. In recent years, he has been popularized by Shlomo Kalbach, Aleph Shalom, and his disciples. The Ishbitzer now becomes very, very popular, but he was, he was Rav Tzadok's Rebbe, Muvak. The Ishbitzer says that the significance of an egg is that a bird, unlike a mammal, is born in two stages. An egg is laid, and then the egg is hatched. Right? So there are two different stages in the emergence of a bird. So too, the Jewish people were born twice. Yetzias Mitzrayim is like the laying of an egg. But until Matan Torah, you don't have the hatching of the egg. So it's to remind us that we like to say, oh, Yetzias Mitzrayim is the birth of the Jewish people. Well, it's like the birth of the Jewish people the same way a chicken lays an egg. But if the egg is not properly fertilized, so to speak, the egg just becomes an egg. It never turns into a live bird. And so too, without Torah to fertilize us, we're just an egg. In other words, we never turn into anything better than that. That's one idea. The second idea of the egg, which already I'm sure you've heard, is that the egg is the food that we give a mourner. We give a mourner, right? The first food after a levaya is an egg. Tisha B'Av we eat an egg, etc. The Sudam of Sekes of Erev Tisha B'Av. And the reason is because an egg, like any oval food, commemorates or signifies the passage of time, the cyclical nature of time, and that even if one is going through a sad tikufa, one should know that things do change. Do you remember the famous beautiful medrash that Shlomo HaMelech commissioned an artisan to make for him something that would always allow him to keep his life in perspective? That he shouldn't get too arrogant, he shouldn't get too sad when there are defeats. So the artisan made a ring that said the words, Gamze Yavor. Gamze Yavor, this too shall pass. And when a person is at the height of the world, and a person might be arrogant, conceited, looking down at people, a person has to remember that doesn't last forever. And on the other side of the coin, when life is very, very difficult and one is suffering, one also knows Gamze Yavor. So the egg is Gamze Yavor, right? It turns, Gamze Yavor. But the question becomes, why are we eating mourner's food the night of the seder? So the Rishonim point out that on one hand we're mourning the lack of a Beis HaMikdash, the lack of a Korban Pesach. If anything, the seder can actually increase our sadness when we remember that we're supposed to be in the Beis HaMikdash, we're supposed to be in Yerushalayim, well, we are in Yerushalayim, but eating the Korban Pesach, etc. You know, the Gemara, just if you think about, again, it's sometimes helpful to try to envision what Pesach was like Bisman HaMikdash, when you had the whole Jewish people here, except for those who have to wait for next month, Pesach Sheni. And here is the interesting thing. The Korban Pesach has to be eaten essentially inside in only one place. So people had to, I don't know how many hotel rooms there were, dining rooms there were, there had to be a lot of different places. But, the Gemara says the following. Once they finished the Korban Pesach, people would go on the roofs of the homes to sing challah. So you could imagine, let's say around midnight time, a million people would be, not everybody, some people I guess were inside, but thousands and thousands of people would be outside singing the challah. And this is what you would experience. So on one hand, we're eating the egg because we have a sadness that we don't have it. A sadness. So we're being comforted that as the Haggadah begins, although now we are still slaves, we're still in Golus, next year we will have the Geula Shleima, etc. Just like Yom Kippur is the same thing. You know, when we describe the Kohen Gadol coming into the Kodesh HaKodashim, and at the end of that whole Seder of Avodah, that complicated, detailed Avodah of Yom Kippur, the Machzor describes the countenance, the radiance, the face of the Kohen Gadol when he leaves the Kodesh HaKodashim. Now, by the way, this wasn't true for every Kohen Gadol. The Machzor is exaggerating a little bit here, because many of the Kohanim Gadolim of the Bayis Sheni actually died right away. They didn't even marry. But it's describing the ideal Kohen Gadol. And in fact, I think I may have pointed out to you at one point, that part of the Machzor is actually taken from the book of Ben Sira, which was describing Shimon HaTzadik. That it was Shimon HaTzadik that looked that way when he left the Kodesh HaKodashim. and you're really, you know, getting into the joy and the beauty of that moment. And then all of a sudden the curtain goes down and it says, Avol, but we don't have this and we don't have that. And if you recall, the whole machzor takes a very depressing turn, going over the Chorban and going over the Gullus and going over the Averus. Right, so that's one reason why we have an egg, the sadness, right? So we have the Yishmasir's reason of the double birth. We have the sadness idea of not having the Korban Pesach and remembering the Zecher L'Chorban. But we would add the following idea, again, which the Rishonim say. And they say there's a specific connection to Pesach night and the Korban Beis HaMikdash, because under the Jewish calendar, the night of Tisha B'Av, or the day of Tisha B'Av, is always the same day of the week as the first day of Pesach that preceded it. So, if the first day of Pesach was Monday night, Tuesday, Tisha B'Av is going to be Monday night and Tuesday. And therefore, what's going on is that we are remembering Tisha B'Av on Leil Pesach. Now, Hashem could have made the calendar any number of ways. Why is it such that it's invariably going to be the case that Tisha B'Av and Pesach are a shidduch? So here is the thought I would like to add a little bit. Every single day of Pesach, except for the first day, is connected to Shavuos. Because when we count the Omer, we are thinking about Shavuos. So every single day of Pesach, except for the first one, the idea of freedom is linked to Torah. The first night of Pesach is the only night where freedom is not yet linked to Torah. So there's a calendrical lesson here. When freedom is not linked to Torah, it will lead to Chorban. So the egg is the substitute for Sviras HaOmer on the first night. Because Sviras HaOmer is there to tell you that freedom has a value only when it's connected to Torah. The first night of Pesach tells me when freedom is not connected to Torah, it's going to be destructive, right? So that's the idea of the egg. But again, with apologies, I think Tirtza was the only one I can see here that was at where I was, Malach HaMishah, so I'm going to repeat something, and again, I ask your indulgence and forgiveness. But as I know a Rosh Hashiva who was once, somebody made a comment, he was repeating himself too much. He says, well, does your grandmother give you the same cake every time you come over? He says, you don't seem to complain. So again, I do apologize for the repetition. But there is a thought I wanted to share with you connected to Kriyas Yamsuf, because it's relevant not only to the end of Pesach that we just had, but it's relevant to Sviras HaOmer, the period that we are facing. And it's also connected to a thought of the Meshech Chachma. First of all, the Vilna Gaon, we start with the Vilna Gaon. The Vilna Gaon has a very, very beautiful observation on the idea that there are two psukim by Kriyas Yamsuf that seem to be almost repetitive with a slight variation. One pasuk says, V'yavo b'nei Yisrael, Biyabasha b'tochayam. B'nei Yisrael came biyabasha into the dry land in the yam. V'amayim lahem choma, and the water was a wall. Miminam umismolam, to their right and to their left. The water was a wall to their right and to their left. Now, the word choma in that pasuk is spelt without a vav. It's chaser. Now, choma without a vav could be read chema, anger. And you know the Medrash. The Medrash actually says that when the water was ordered to split, the water was angry. The water, the angel of the water, whatever that means, was arguing with God and basically saying, why should we split to save the Jewish people and kill the Egyptians? Halalo Bdei Avodah Zarah. The Egyptians are idolaters, and the Bnei Yisrael are idolaters. Ma nishtanu eilu me'eilu. Right, so the water also has a manishtanu, right? Manishtanu eilu me'eilu. Why are they different? That's chema. Now, a few psukim later, there's another verse that almost says the same thing. Ve'yavo b'nei Yisrael b'soch hayom b'yabasha v'amayim lahem choma miminam u'mismalam. But here the word choma is spelled with the vav, so you don't have a double meaning. Choma just means a wall. So, the Vilna Gaon asks three questions. Question number one, why does the Torah virtually repeat itself in the space of five verses? What's the point of saying the whole pasuk again? Number two, why does the first pasuk say, B'yabasha b'toch hayam, and the second pasuk says, B'toch hayam b'yabasha, just inversion of order? And the third kasha is, why is choma chaser the first time, which gives rise to the double meaning of anger and wall, and it's male the second time, which doesn't give you the double meaning? Like, these are the three kashas of the Vilna Gaon. And the Vilna Gaon ingeniously gives a teretz that answers all three kashas. And that is, the two psukim are not just repeating the same idea, they are referring to two different groups within Am Yisrael. We know that most of the Jews, as they face that water, they are really literally terror-stricken. They are paralyzed. They have no way. They really feel the Egyptians are coming after them, even though it's a relatively small number. As the Ibn Ezra points out, the number of Jews leaving Mitzrayim was many, many times larger than all of Pharaoh's army. But the Ibn Ezra says, the slave mentality of having your masters come back paralyzes you, frightens you. You become disabled. So most of the Jews didn't have emunah. Most of them didn't have faith. They didn't believe. But then you'll recall that there were some people, and the leader of them was the head of the tribe of Yehuda, Nachshon ben Aminadav. But in addition, there were people from Shevet Binyamin, who jumped into the sea, and they were willing to go up to their necks or up to their noses. And because of their emunah, there was Kriyas Yamsaf. So this is what the Vilna Gaon says. The first pasuk says, V'yavo b'nei Yisrael b'yabasha b'toch hayam. B'nei Yisrael went into the dry land. This refers to the Hamonan, who refused to enter the Yamsuf till it already was dry land. There were mechusrei emunah. For those people, the word choma is written without a vav, because for those people, we have the double meaning that the Yamsuf says, these people lack emunah, they're no better than the Egyptians. Manishtanu eilu me'eilum. These were the people that were b'yabasha b'toch hayam. They have to see the yabasha before they jump in. But the next pasuk, v'yavo b'nei Yisrael l'toch hayam b'yabasha, that refers to Nachshon ben Aminadav, who went into the sea that then became dry land. For them, the Malachim don't have a taina. Manishtanu eilu mi'eilu, why are they different than the Egyptians? Certainly they're different. They have emunah, they have mesiras nefesh, they're willing to give their life for Hashem. That's why choma in that pasuk is only one meaning. Choma with a vav, a wall, there is no chema. Right? That's tremendous. The first pasuk are those Jews that lack emunah, and that's why it says yabasha b'toch hayam. They have to see the yabasha. And that's why choma is without a vav. There was chema. The second pasuk is Nachshon ben Aminadav and Shevet Binyamin, who had emunah. That's betoch hayam, that then became yabasha, and the water was a choma. There was no chema for them. Yeah.
Should the order then be reversed? In other words, first have a vav.
Yeah, you know, you have a very good point, because obviously chronologically, It was Nachshon first. But I think we have to say the following. The Torah is first describing the miracle that happened to the Jewish people. It's then telling you why it happened. And that which happened is because of the people. In other words, that in which there was a Yabasha for everybody else is because of those who jumped into the Yam that became the Yabasha. So it's often common in a biblical narrative that the main event is described and then the reason for the event is given afterwards, even though it refers to an event that preceded the event that was described. So this is a sort of, by the way, I'm sure you've heard the famous Gemara that says that it is as great for Hashem to make a shidduch, or as difficult, whatever that means exactly, to make a shidduch as it is to split the Red Sea, or the Reed Sea, Yam Suf, whatever Yam Suf is. And all the Mefarshim discuss why do we compare making shidduchim to Kriyas Yam Suf. So the Maharal gives an explanation. The Maharal says that we find that Kriyas Yam Suf, HaKadosh Baruch Hu made the water act opposite of its nature. The nature of the water through gravity is to come together, and Hashem forced the water to behave keneged its teva. So the Maharal says by a shidduch it's the same thing but in the opposite. The Maharal says teva ha'adam lehispodeh. Now we'll have to explain this. It is the nature of the human being to want to be alone, and in a shidduch Hashem puts into the human being the desire to be connected. And therefore, just like Kriyas Yam Suf, Hashem is Mishana, the Teva of the Mayim, which is to come together. And Hashem makes it be apart. With the Shidduch, Hashem takes the Teva of a person to want to be alone, now I'll have to explain that, and creates the desire to be together. Now, we have to understand, what does the Maharal mean? It's the nature of a person to want to be alone. I mean, we would say for character, a person normally, man is a social animal, even Aristotle. Those are Aristotle's words. But I think the Maharal means, not that it's the nature of a person to want to be isolated, but it's the nature of a person to want to be in control of everything at all one time. And the concept of a shidduch and the concept of a marriage is the willingness to give in, the willingness to compromise, the willingness to give up a little of one's freedom in order to create a relationship. And the Maharal says that's actually a miracle, because human beings, particularly men, even more than women now, don't like to do that. They don't like to do that. In fact, they bring b'shem the Zohar, an idea that the reason why men in particular have the difficulty of surrendering a bit of autonomy in their life is because Adam existed in the world, at least for a short time, without Chava. Now this depends on, exactly, there's machlokas in the Gemara, how men and women were created. According to one view in the Gemara, man and woman came into the world exactly the same time as a two-headed creature, two bodies that were joined, like Siamese twins, or conjoined twins we call them today, and Hashem separated them. According to that, men and women came into the world exactly the same time. But the Zohar is going like the other view in the Gemara, which is a simple reading of the Chumash. First there was man, and woman was created from man. Now the Zohar says there's a powerful spiritual implication from that. And that is, since man's essential first moments were in isolation, the nature, again, these are generalizations, the nature of the male identity is one that seeks separation, autonomy, control, and independence. And any time there is a surrender of control, that is an assault on the essential nature of the man. A woman was born in a context of community. There never was a moment in her existence when there wasn't another. And as a result, the Zohar says, a woman does not, again, these are generalizations, I know that each of us has aspects of both, you know, we don't have pure types because of our society, whatever it is. But the Zohar says, a woman naturally gravitates towards alliances, towards connections, towards community, because that is not a contradiction to her essential self. Because her essential self was born
in the context of community. Man, his essential self is one of isolation, and it requires an act of will and surrender, kineged hatera, miraculous, so to speak, for a man to be able to surrender it. Now, this manifests itself in all sorts of trivial ways. The old cliche that men don't like to ask directions. That's why I'm pretty sure that GPSs were invented by men. No question about it. So we would never have to ask directions.
Woman's voice,
but and the concept is, because asking directions is an admission of weakness. It's needing somebody. Men don't want to need somebody. Well, that's true. Even that. No, but I know it is very true. I mean, I remember in the olden days, before there were GPSs, I would have to be lost at least 2 hours before I'll break down. Now, I remember, my wife would say, as soon as we're coming out of the driveway, let's go ask directions, So, but these are minor points or whatever, but these are very, very deep. These are deep psychological realities. This is what the Maharal means when he says it's the nature of man, and he's really referring more to man, to be alone in the sense of not surrendering that autonomy. I would even suggest, as a speculation, I don't have a clear marker for this, that, in the modern Orthodox communities, the open Orthodox communities, there's all sorts of discussions about women, minyanim, even in Yerushalayim, partnership minyanim. It's a very... in certain circles, it's a very, very controversial topic. And, suffice it to say that halachically, women don't count for a minyan. I mean, that's the reality of the halacha. But one might suggest the following. What is a minyan? A minyan is basically an idea that you can't do certain things by yourself. You need to join with other people. The getter is... Halacha creates the institution of minyan for those who need it in order to absorb that idea. The man has to be told, you can't do everything yourself. You need to go and connect with a group of people. Don't think that somehow, you're deficient because you need others. The getter is, since a woman beteva has that sense of community going all the way back. So as we find in many areas, that which is not needed for a person's tikkun does not become the institution that Hashem gives them. And that's a speculation as to why women don't need minyan, because inherently their existence, there is connection and love. Again, this is a bit of a digression, but again, just reminds me of, there was a well-known social psychologist, Carol Gilligan. She was a professor at Harvard. I think she died... a short while ago. She wrote a very pioneering book in the 1970s called A Different Voice. Actually, a very, very interesting book. This was during the height of the first feminist, feminism and the like, and many of the radical feminists were basically saying there is absolutely no difference between men and women. Everything is environmental, everything is social. Boys and girls are exactly the same. And she, as a woman, actually did psychological research to show that men and women, boys and girls, have a different view of reality from their earliest years in childhood. Now, you still might argue, that just means by 2 years old they've been brainwashed. But she administered a bunch of tests, questionnaires to very young children, and she showed how boys and girls answer the questions very differently from a very young age. And one of the, she has many, many different examples, but one example that I remember was, she said, let's say that you have a child, God forbid, that's deathly ill. And there's only one drugstore in town that has the medicine that could save your child's life. And the drugstore is not 24 hours, maybe an unrealistic hypothetical. And there's nobody you could call. What do you do for your child? So every boy uniformly answered, you take a rock, you break the window, and you take the medicine. Now, that is actually a 100% correct answer. I mean, pikuach nefesh. Every girl said that you leave, be sure to leave a note and call the police that you're doing it. again, the girls also said you break, if you have to, you break a rock. But the point that she was making is that men, boys, tend to be fixated like a laser on the most important part of a problem, and they'll focus on that, but they're going to ignore all the other repercussions, all the other relationships. They'll kind of have blinders on and not consider the other implications of things. It says, because a woman is more attuned to relationships, so she understands that even if the primary goal is getting the medicine, which of course it is, you can't ignore the other things. In fact, some of Forshim say that this is the explanation of a Gemara that is sometimes taken as pejorative and insulting, but could actually be a very profound compliment in some ways. There's a Gemara that says, Nashim datan kalos. Women are light-headed. Now, this could, of course, be interpreted as a very, somewhat of a negative, flighty, they don't think. But listen to what one of the Forshim said. To be kal means to be swift. Swift, to run fast, and kal. You should be kal kinesher, you should be swift like an eagle to do Hashem's will. So he says, datan kalos is the ability to juggle many, many balls at one time, to swiftly disengage from one thing to another. Men, again, these are generalizations, men tend to be intense and focused, whether it's they're learning Gemara, hopefully, or whether it's a football game, whatever it is, don't disturb, as it were. So datan kalos is the notion of, because again, when you're raising children especially, you got to be able to switch gears all the time. You have to move that. You can't say, I'm making the soup right now, don't cry about whatever you're doing. So the thing is, you see that HaKadosh Baruch, so Carol Gilgan's point was that HaKadosh Baruch didn't create two genders. She wasn't bringing God into it, but the theological point is HaKadosh Baruch didn't create two genders to be identical. That would have been a pretty much of a waste of resources. HaKadosh Baruch Hu B'davka created two genders because each brings a certain mida that brings a perfection to the world by their connection to each other. The one needs the intense focus and laser-like concentration, and the other is to respond quickly to the different things that happen in a life. So to say which is better is kind of a meaningless question, because the answer is you need both of these ideas, both of these forces in life. Okay, this was just by way of a long digression. I was just explaining why a shidduch is compared to Kriyas Yamsuf. But okay. But let's go back to Kriyas Yamsuf itself. And that is, I quoted the Medrash to you, Hamayim lehem choma. The water was a wall. So once again, the Medrash is the first pasuk. Choma is without above. Chema. There was what's called kitrug. Kitrug is prosecution, accusation. The angel basically said, Manish Tanu, Elu Me Elu, they don't deserve. The Meshech Chachma asks a very interesting question. The Jewish people have just emerged 7 days previously or 6 days previously from Mitzrayim. And there had been a whole year of plagues. Right? The 10 plagues took a total of a year. Although it's hard to know how that works out exactly, but that's what the Mishnah says. Every single plague, Hashem made a division between Bnei Yisrael and Mitzrayim. Dan, Sephardea, Kenim, Arab, Deber, Shechin, Makas, Becharos, only the Egyptians died, the Jews didn't die. How come the angels didn't complain then? Why is there a kitruk, chema, only by Kriyas Yamsuf, and there was no Manish Tanu, every single marker there should have been a statement, hey, why are you punishing the Egyptians? The Jews are no better. Manish Tanu Eilu Me'eilu. This is the Meshech Chachma's question. And the Meshech Chachma gives the following terrors. It is true that the Jewish people in Mitzrayim were on a very low level of Tumah. They were on the level, actually very high level of Tumah, but a very low spiritual level. They were the 49th level of impurity. And you can only go to number 50, and they were sinking fast, and their Madrega was so low. By the way, that's the one-fifth that survived. Four-fifths that died hit 50. So when we say 49th level, we're talking about the one-fifth. that survived. And the Arizal explains, the Gemara doesn't say it specifically, that when the Chumash tells me they didn't have time to let their dough rise, they had to bake it right away, that is because, not only because Paro was saying, get out of here, but the Arizal says, Hashem told them, if you don't leave this minute, you're going to hit level number 50. So we don't even know what that means, to be told, you have 1 minute. It's like Saddam and I'm over, right? Get out now or you're gone. We can understand that physically. I mean, when there's, but it's very hard for us to understand spiritually how that could possibly mean another second and you hit level number 50. By the way, now you might think the following. You might think, well, those Jews were pretty bad, you know, because the truth of the matter is, Rav Chaim Volozhiner says, we might even be below level number 50, because Rav Chaim Volozhiner says the concept that once you hit level 50, you're irredeemable, only applied before Matan Torah. When there wasn't the Torah, you didn't have a way to pull yourself out. Baruch Hashem, once we have a Torah, even if we're in the Shar Nun, so we can't really pride ourselves that we haven't hit bottom. Maybe we have, but the Kodesh Baruch Hu has given us a lifeline that the Jews then did not have. So, if indeed the Jewish people in Mitzrayim were in the 49th level of Tumah, what was their Zechus? So there are different Chazals. One Chazal say that's why Hashem gave us the blood of the Korban Pesach and the blood of the Bris Milah to kind of pull us out. Do you remember that's the famous drasha, the Haggadah quotes with Yechezkel? In one of Yechezkel's Nevuahs, the Jew people are described as an abandoned baby that was found in mud and filth. And the parent cleans the baby and raises the baby. That's really us. Hashem took care of us. But it says, V'at Eirum Me'eria, Orum Me'eria, you were naked and bereft. And I said, V'damayach Chayi, with your blood you shall live, with Yotru Shul Chazal of a whole drasha, that Orum Be'eria means we were naked from the mitzvahs. And Hashem gave us the mitzvahs of blood. Damayach is a Lashon Rabin, Dam Pesach and Dam Milah. That's one answer. But the other answer Chazal give is that the Jewish people had certain merits in Mitzrayim, notwithstanding their being idol worshippers and not even doing Bris Milah except for Shevet Levi. And these merits are, again, there are different lists, but the list of the Mechilta is they didn't intermarry, they didn't change their names, they didn't change their language, and they didn't speak Lashon Hara against each other. Again, if we ask ourselves what Madrega we are on, let's go against that list and see what it is. But okay. Now, the Meshech Chachma points out the following. If a Jew didn't change his name, or a Jew spoke Hebrew, or a Jew didn't intermarry, or a Jew didn't speak Lashon Hara, it couldn't have been because they were from, as we would say, because they were Ovdei Avodah Zarah, they were worshipping Egyptian gods. It had nothing to do with religiosity. So what was it? What's the big deal? Somebody has a Hebrew name, especially in Israel, but everyone has a Hebrew name, basically. Have a Hebrew name, so that counts for something? Goes to a Tel Aviv discotheque? Like, what exactly does it mean? It's not because you want to be from. So the Meshech Chachma says, these four indicators are not indicators of religiosity. They are indicators of Achdus and Avas Yisrael. That you want to identify as a Jew. You want to say, I am part of Klal Yisrael. These are my people. When they suffer, I suffer. In fact, even the not speaking Lashon Hara actually meant not so much that Reuben didn't gossip about Shimon to Levi, maybe that they did, but it means they didn't turn negative information over to the Egyptians. Okay. There was a concept of trying to be together. So what is Chazal teaching us? Chazal are teaching us that even though the Jewish people were on the 49th level of Tumah, even though they were idolaters, even though they were not practicing Bris Milah, they were worthy of redemption because they wanted to be connected to each other. They cared for each other. They loved each other. They felt the suffering of their fellow Jew. And they had a united front against the oppressors. Now, is that enough to be redeemed? No. Eventually we are redeemed to receive the Torah. It is not the end point. Jewish ethnic identification is not the purpose of redemption, but it was the prerequisite of redemption. Again, forgive me if I'm repeating what I may have mentioned before. When I used to live in Chicago, I lived in Chicago many years ago. So in those days, although it's not so much today, the main Jewish avenue in Chicago was Devon Avenue. Now it's still, now it's half Indian, half Jewish. But I remember I used to walk on Devon Avenue, and there was a kosher-style delicatessen called the Bagel. And I think it might still be there. Now, the bagel was kosher-style, meaning it was treif. It was a treif restaurant, but they had Jewish-type food. And I remember walking by, and I saw a sign in the window that says, "We serve cholent on Shabbos." So, you know, you walk by that thing. Else says, I think it says free glass of wine for Kiddush or something like that. So you walk by a treif restaurant, and you think about what type of, worthless Judaism is that some guy says, "Oh, I gotta have cholent because my grandmother used to make cholent on Shabbos, and I'll have it non-kosher wine and non-kosher foods, and they'll probably even give you a free piece of matzah for Pesach when you eat, you know, treif meat and everything else." And, you know, of course, you can look at that and you can laugh and you can say how trivial, how stupid, gastronomic Judaism. It's not even cardiac Judaism. I'm a Jew in my heart. This is, I'm a Jew in my stomach. That's even one level lower than just being a Jew in your heart. But as I get older, hopefully wiser, I see that this is not totally without merit. Because some person who might be very, very far from Torah, far from Hashem, has a little bit of a tug, and he says, "You know, I want to connect a little bit. I know that Zaidi used to make a blessing on wine on Shabbos. I want to come and do that. Bubba used to make cholent. I want to do that." And if you think that that's so worthless, remember that that's fundamentally what the Jews did in Mitzrayim. They didn't change their name. They didn't change their language. But they were idol worshippers. They weren't doing it for mitzvahs. They were doing it because they wanted to be makasher themselves to our mitzvah. And that means a lot. To connect yourself to them. You know, the Rambam in Hilchos Tshuva enumerates a number of people who don't have a share in Olam Haba. And here is the interesting thing. Even if a person violates Shabbos, which is a very, very serious Aveira, and there'll be punishment, he does get a share in Olam Haba. He doesn't lose his Olam Haba because he violates Shabbos. But the Rambam has a category of a person who loses Olam Haba, unless he does tshuva, of course. He can always do tshuva. And that's a person that is Poresh Midarchei Hatzibur. Poresh Midarchei Hatzibur literally means a person who separates from the ways of the congregation. And the Rambam says, this is a person who might keep all the commandments, he might keep all the mitzvahs, but he really doesn't care what happens to his fellow Jews. When good things happen, it doesn't make him particularly happy. When bad things happen, it doesn't bother him that much. It's not his family. So the Rambam says, even if such a person keeps all the other commandments, he does not have a share in Olam Haba because he cuts himself off from Am Yisrael. And again, you see this in Mitzrayim, that the yesod of Yetzias Mitzrayim, the foundational behavior and attitude that allowed us to be redeemed, was that sense of achdus, not changing our name, our language. Oh. So now the Meshech Chachma says the following. We now understand, remember the Meshech Chachma's question? The Meshech Chachma's question was, why was there a kitrug of the angels only by Kriyas Yamsuf and not in Mitzrayim? So the Meshech Chachma says, in Mitzrayim, as bad as we were, there was achdus, unity, togetherness. And when there's achdus, unity, togetherness, Hashem looks at us with a certain forgiveness, a certain tolerance. In other words, kavyachal, on some level, He is willing to overlook a certain amount of misbehavior. Because we become a whole that is greater than the sum of the defective parts. I'm defective, and he's defective, and she's defective, but the whole is greater than that. Actually, you see this even earlier in the Torah. Rashi himself brings that, you know, we have two cataclysmic events in the beginning of Bereishis. One is the Mabul, right, the flood, Hashem destroys the world. And the other is Migdol Babel, the Tower of Babel, when they built a tower to try to rebel against Hashem, and Hashem scattered them by changing their languages. Now Rashi points out that Migdol Babel was in some sense worse than the marble, because Migdol Babel was an attack on Hashem, whatever it means, and I'm not going to get into that now, but they literally won. Actually, Jonathan Ape, just by the way, says Migdol Babel was a rocket designed to go to outer space. He wrote this 350 years ago. He says it was. Rabbi Yonasan says it was a launch pad, a rocket. They had the technology for rockets. Whatever it was, but certainly it was a merida against Hashem. What was the marble? The marble was gezel, theft, violence against people. And yet, the marble, the whole world was destroyed except for Noah and his children. Dor HaFlaga and Hashem spared the world. They were just scattered. Zakt Rashi, Gadol HaShalom. That the door of Haflaga, there was Shalom and Achdus between them. So Hashem overlooked even the hate of Kfira B'Iker. The door HaMabel was Machlokas and Sinai. Hashem destroyed them. So the Meshech Chachma says, in Mitzrayim, you had that achta, so even if there was a Avodah Zarah, there was no Kitron. What happened at Kriyas Yamsif though? Kriyas Yamsif, we find, and this is his teretz, why there's a Kitron at Kriyas Yamsif. But Kriyas Yamsif, we find that the achtus that existed in Mitzrayim began to disintegrate. Where do we find it disintegrated? So here he uses this chazal. There's a chazal that say, by Kriyas Yamsuf, in the panic of the moment, different groups began to advocate different strategies. One group said, let's jump into the sea, not through Amuna, let's jump into the sea to commit suicide. Another group said, let us surrender and go back to Mitzrayim. A third group said, let us wage war. And a fourth group said, let us cry out to the nations of the world, to the United Nations, who will come in and rescue us. I've always thought that they were the most foolish of all the four groups. But all four groups were up. Now, the Meshech Chach was giving a little bit of a twist here. I mean, I would have just thought these are just four different approaches. The Meshech Chach will learn differently. He's learning this Medrash, that in the panic of the moment, each person just cared about what would be best for them. Again, it's similar, the tragedy of the ferry sinking, was it in Korea? Was it, the captain may have left first, I don't want to be Motzi Shem on him either. But the idea that sometimes in the panic of the moment, and, Rahman al-Sam, we should never have to face it, but you never know how you're going to behave. In the panic of the moment, sometimes your own survival instinct takes precedence. Or even your suicide instinct, depending if you want to get out of it. And the Meshech Chachma says, Kriyas Yamsuf, it was each person for himself. So at that point, the Meshech Chachma says, once I separate myself from Klal Yisrael, once I make myself as an individual the most important thing, then Hashem examines my record. And if I'm an Oved Avodah Zarah, whatever it is, we all know what he said. The Kitrid of the Malachim, you see, which means the following. This is a powerful thought. Because the Meshech Chachma is saying, when there's a lack of achdus and sinna in Am Yisrael, it's not simply that Hashem considers that to be a sin, but rather it brings all our other sins together. Because when we're one nation, Hashem looks at the whole without looking at the chesronos of the part. But when we separate ourselves, Hashem looks at one person and says, oh, you have this thing, and another person this thing. In other words, all the Averis come back. Avodah Zarah comes back. It's not just Sinna Shechinam that comes back. Avodah Zarah comes back. Halalu Ovdei Avodah Zarah. V'halalu Ovdei Avodah Zarah. Right? And this is why there was a Kitruk only by Kriyas Yamsuf. Because Kriyas Yamsuf, in the panic of Kriyas Yamsuf, the four kitos, the four groups, represent a survivalist strategy of looking after number one at that point. again, you can draw your own conclusions as to what we have to do in our generation. But there is no question. Listen, I'm not going to say this is the worst tikkun we've ever been in, because obviously the Beis HaMikdash itself was destroyed because of sin aschinah. In fact, although I don't like to quote him as a source, Josephus, you know, Yosef ben Matisyahu, very, very interesting figure. He was an eyewitness to the Korban. He was a Jewish general who turned over, he surrendered to the Romans, and he spent most of the, at least the second half of the war against the Jews in Rome. So he's kind of our Benedict Arnold. But he did write a history, and he was an eyewitness to the Korban. And in truth, he's a complicated figure, because at least he claimed a lot of what he wrote was to make the Jews look good in the eyes of the Romans. He thought he was helping the Jewish people in some way. But he recounts the following. I don't know if it's true, but it's a very, very interesting observation. First of all, he describes the fact that the Jewish zealots themselves were fighting each other for who should control Yerushalayim. Now, this the Gemara itself talks about. But this is what he describes. This is truly phenomenal. He is saying that different camps of zealots had taken control of the Beis HaMikdash, and they were shooting spears and arrows across the Beis HaMikdash. And the Kohanim, this is before the Churban, the Kohanim were doing the Avodah. They had to duck the arrows that were being shot. Now, he then quotes Titus. Titus HaRasha, of course, is the very general who became Roman emperor, who destroyed the Beis HaMikdash. But he describes Titus at one point looking and observing all of this Jewish infighting. And Titus tells one of his generals, you know, maybe I don't have to waste any soldiers to destroy this city. If I wait long enough, they'll do it themselves for me. Again, I don't know if it's true, but there's a certain powerful truth in that statement, whether it was factually said or not. So we've had bad times before, meaning I'm actually saying that this is not the worst. You know, people say this is the worst, you know, thing that Klaus has ever had. We've had times that maybe were worse. But I think we do have to admit that we do live in a tikufa where such machlokas is rampant. And we have to know that, unfortunately, when there's machlokas among Klal Yisrael, we become vulnerable in many, 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 many ways. And even in a society where Jews aren't keeping Torah to the maximum, when there's achdus, there's a certain forgiveness factor that is built into the Dinei Shemayim that we don't have when there's a lack of achdus in Yisrael. This is the chiluk the Meshech Chachma makes between Kriyas Yamsuf and Mitzrayim, where there was that achdus. I think I mentioned this. The Sfas Emes says in the paragraph, "Yehi she'amdala v'seinu v'lanu," right, that which has kept us alive. So the Haggadah says, "Shelo echad bilvad amad aleinu l'chaloseinu." It is not only one that is standing up against us to destroy us. El shebechol dor v'dor omdim aleinu l'chaloseinu. Right? And HaKadosh Baruch Hu Matzilenu Miyadam. So the Sfas Emes has a nice homiletical twist. Instead of translating Shalai Echad Bilvad, it is not only one, he translates it, it is only the fact that we are not one. Shalo Echad Bilvad, it is only the fact that we're not Echad. That is Amar Aleinu L'Chaloseinu, and I mentioned before Benjamin Franklin's remark at the time of, I believe, the Declaration of Independence, that we certainly have to hang together or we shall hang separately. And once again, this is the Matzav of Am Yisrael. So Be'ezras Hashem, this is now, why is this Nogeyat the Sfira? Again, we'll elaborate on this other weeks, but just to say the Kitzur, that we know that even though Sfira inherently should be a happy time, a joyous time, we're looking forward to Matan Torah, but it is tinged with sadness and avelos because of the deaths of the students of Rabbi Akiva. And the Gemara tells us the students of Rabbi Akiva died because they did not show proper kavod zelozeh. So all the portion tell us our goal as we prepare for Matan Torah is to have kavod and respect for our fellow Jews, and that is the only way we will be zocher to receive Hashem's Torah. So have a good day.